Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greg Haynes with you. Welcome to Full Throttle as the COVID-19 coronavirus chaos just continues around the world. This global pandemic, who knows when we listen back to this, how long it will have lasted. But it's just going on and on and on. This is the Eurosport Full Throttle Bike Racing Podcast for Monday, the 30th of March, 2020. We have coming up in the next couple of minutes, Mick Shanley with us. Mick is the crew chief of Loris Baz in the World Superbike Championship with Tenkata Racing. Really busy year coming up for him, hopefully, whenever we next get back underway again. And we have Loris Baz on the podcast with us a few weeks ago, so we'll get Mick's version of events in a few minutes from now. But in the meantime, quick update on the race calendars, what is actually going on. You may well know that in Formula One, they've had the cancellation of the Australian and Monaco Grand Prix and plenty more postponements. So at the moment, no racing for F1 until Canada in the middle of June, the Circuit de Gilles Villeneuve in Montreal at the very earliest. Latest casualties in terms of postponements, the Spanish MotoGP in Jerez, which had been penned in for a long time as a potential season opener, that's gone. I expect Le Mans to be gone as well. Again, these aren't cancellations, these are postponements. Let's see what happens over the next few days. BSB, very much affected as well, the British Superbike Championship. We've had postponements of the opening three rounds, all wiped off the schedule for the time being at least. Silverstone, Alton Park and Donington National. So the first BSB date remaining on the calendar for now is Snetterton, on the weekend of the 20th and 21st of June. Plenty of issues for World Superbikes as well. And although nothing's been officially confirmed, my personal feeling is we're just not going to get any racing anywhere, to be honest, until July at the earliest. I hope I am wrong, but who knows what's going to happen. Of course, all this is going to depend on government restrictions and the casualty counts. Sad to say that, but the casualty counts due to COVID-19 around the world. Plenty more innovation, let's say, coming up, I hope, as well, from Eurosport over the next few weeks. So watch out for activity online. A few ideas are in place there. But in the meantime, the podcast continues and Mick Shanley joins us to discuss Australia and his feelings for what we hope will be the rest of this bike racing season. Well, Mick, I'm not quite sure when I'm going to see you again because this is a bit of a strange situation we've got here, isn't it?
Yeah, hiya, Greg. It's, definitely strange. I should be just arriving back at the airport in the UK after Qatar, but yeah, another weekend off.
Yeah, and we just don't know for how long either. But if we look back at the weekend we did have, and it seems like World Superbikes was very fortunate in many ways to actually get at least one full racing weekend, and what a great one it was. Seventh place, eighth place in the three races does not reflect what a good weekend it was, in my opinion, for the Tenkata team and Loris Baz, because you really did have the pace to, I would say, actually win a race in Australia.
Yeah, that was kind of our feeling as well. Things have gone really well through winter testing and then through the pre-season testing. Phillip Island, we were strong all the way through. We'd worked hard on race tyre times and we knew what we were kind of capable to achieve. And yeah, I came away a little bit disappointed with the final result, but again, you know, very happy with the fact that we are competitive.
Witt and I were joking, Mick, I don't know whether you've watched the races back, but in the commentary we were joking about the fact that your heart may have skipped a beat. And James said Mick Shanley probably had the toolbox out after those scary moments Loris had going off onto the grass. It must have been a bit of a scary one for you watching that.
Yeah, it was all kind of a bit of a blur, really. And normally I'm really methodical and kind of write everything down, and all these sector times I sort of write. I don't really watch much TV footage, to be honest, but yeah, my sheet with all my sector times on was just a scribble with loads of missing bits and then wondering what lap we're on. And so yeah, it was a bit of a hectic race to watch, but no, good fun, good entertainment for everybody.
So when you're in the garage then as the crew chief, what are you actually doing then? You're literally hardly watching the telly, but looking at the timing screen, are you? And just writing down every single sector time all through the race?
Yeah, I do, because I'm always trying to analyse and see, you know, where we're strong in sectors and where we're losing out. If we start to slow down in a particular sector, you know, how's our time dropping away compared to other riders? And I'm always looking at those sort of things to see where we can improve and where we need to make a step ready for the next race. It's interesting to see at times, but that was the frustrating thing as well. Obviously, in race one, we had the sort of close moment with Alex and went wide at turn one and dropped down to 11th. But at the end of the race, we could see we were definitely the strongest person on track at that point. So we knew we were going to be competitive, and it's just a matter of time of being able to get it done.
And how has it happened so quickly, Mick? Because it has happened quickly, hasn't it? It doesn't seem long since Loris was left on the sidelines at the end of 2018 when he lost the ride with Altea BMW. Then, of course, he was back before we knew it halfway through last year with Ten Carter. But it just seems to have progressed so quickly since then. You basically come in with a road bike transformed to a race bike. How have you guys gotten to such a high level so quickly?
Yeah, obviously we do get good support from Yamaha Europe, and we get a lot of the same material available to us that the factory guys get and GRT, so that helps. It was a little bit tough last year when you come in mid-season, because everybody's done their pre-season testing. They've done four or five races, it was, when we arrived in the championship, and we had a lot to kind of contend with. I was in the fortunate position that I'd worked on Yamaha before in 2015 with Josh Brooks, so I was a little bit familiar. Ten Carter boys, it was almost like it was a strange animal. You know, they'd worked on a Fireblade for the past how long, and the bike hadn't really changed so much. So there was a lot of new things for the mechanics and guys to get used to, and also the relationship with Yamaha and how we had to order things and information flows and things. So Loris had to get going, and yeah, we're almost, I think, running before we could walk with it in the first couple of rounds, but knew that there was the potential there. So, you know, we built as the season went on to be reasonably strong. You know, we just missed out on the podium at MagniCore, and we had a few fourth places, so we knew it was there. We just needed to get a good winter's testing program underway to try some of the things that you maybe don't get chance to try really methodically in a race weekend. So we revisited a few different things and tried some new avenues and some new directions on settings, which seemed to work well, some new parts, some actually having some time with the bike with Ten Carter, and we could understand where we were lacking and start to build some of our own Ten Carter innovations, if you will, to try and help things on. And yeah, winter test being solid. And I think that showed when we turned up at Phillip Island. We've actually arrived in the season with that grounding behind us, and we're ready to go racing now.
In the situation you're in, Mick, can you go down various avenues, or is it fair to say there is one route you need to find and go down, or are there a selection of different options, and then once you've picked one, you have to go down that route? How does it sort of work from a development point of view?
And obviously you're tied on certain things with regulation.
Yeah.
So there's things that you can do and you can't do. But yeah, for me, it's just very important to react to your rider and what your rider wants. And obviously we work together a lot. We talk a lot. And we sort of analyze that area where we know that we're weak. And it's what you can find to try and minimize that area without impacting negatively on all the other areas. So you know, I revisited the Loris's comments from the last year, and also we have like a priority list of development at the end of his debrief sheet from Qatar, and starts was a huge one for him. He said, you know, even if we have the pace to win the race, if I can't get off the line, it'll never happen. So that's a main priority for him. And the second one was acceleration stability. And then, you know, we've tried things and done things over the winter, which his starts have improved a lot. Normally we lost a row, maybe two rows. But in Phillip Island, we're actually possible for us to start to gain one or two positions off the line, which is a huge turnaround from where we were. And then things that we've done with the rear of the bike, some different parts, some different settings, have definitely improved the stability on acceleration. So we seem to have made a step forward there. Then obviously there's the things that have come from Yamaha, like the new aerodynamics are definitely a step better, especially for somebody as big as Loris. That's helped. And hopefully when we can start to run the new engine, that'll give us another little step.
Do you seem to have that telepathic connection with Loris, Mick? You know, we see this between people like Pero Ribeiro and Jonathan Rea and Giovanni Crupie and Scott Redding, I think, is another good example. They almost know already what each other are thinking when the rider comes into the garage, and you're already that sort of one step ahead without having to explain all the basic stuff. Are you guys a bit like that as well?
I think, yeah, things are growing. We have a really good relationship. I love working with him. He's, you know, he's really professional. His feedback's brilliant. It's feedback that I like to work with in a way. Doesn't overcomplicate things, but he knows where he's struggling and he knows what he wants. So we work quite well together. I think I've done some things that people might think, oh, that's a bit strange or a bit crazy if you approach it to a rider. But whenever I've had that gut feeling and the hunch and said, listen, I know this might sound weird, but we need to push in this direction, and Loris has gone and tried it, it's been positive. So that builds a lot of trust between you. So, you know, for Loris as well, if he complains to me, it's like I've got his ear a little bit now, where he doesn't worry so much about the change that I'm going to make, because he's pretty sure that it's going to be in the right direction. So we have got onto a good level there, where we can work fast, we can work quickly through things, analyze them quickly, and sort of move on to the next one. So development, you know, speed increases quite a lot. I love working with him, to be honest. It's always fun. We always have a laugh. It's serious when it needs to be. But, we have a real good atmosphere with all the 10 Carter guys in the box.
Yeah, they are a really good bunch. And it does feel as well, from the outside at least, like it's not a sort of too many cooks scenario. There's not that many people in the team, are there, in its current guys? And it seems like everyone's dedicated to their own role. They can really get on with what they are being paid to do. And it seems to be working really well.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing that's happened, you know, with everything that's gone on with the change from Honda to Yamaha, and everybody in the team, everybody's pulling in the same direction.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to do the best, and it's just us in a little unit. We've all got our own roles, and we all work together really well, taking care of all those individual bits. And when we piece it all together, it's showing dividends. It's a little bit strange in a way, you know. Obviously, Ten Carter had come from the Honda, which can be very political and very structured, and we don't have any of that really finicky politics to sort of deal with in a way, which is a real big benefit for us as a small team. It allows us a little bit of freedom and don't have to worry too much about what we say on interviews or things. Yeah, we've just got that freedom to kind of explore and try new things and be a little bit free. It's good.
I know exactly what you mean, because even arranging this podcast interview, for example, obviously we're lucky enough to be in contact with each other directly and we can arrange it. You check with the team and we're away. Whereas sometimes with other teams, people need to check with the press officer. Sometimes they want a recording of the interview before it goes out, a conference call with the team press officer. It's a completely different way of doing things, isn't it?
Yeah. I remember our first kind of one when it was Red Bull Honda, and I was just starting to work with Jake. And although I didn't say anything out of line, I kind of got in trouble for not verifying it first. But it's I don't have those sort of things anymore.
So I've got to go back to what you said before when you said sometimes you might do weird or crazy things. What are they, Mick? People are going to be wondering, what is it you've done?
It's I know when we started with the Yamaha last year, this is just an example, you know. Yeah. We sort of, okay, said to Yamaha, what's your base setting? Where do we need to work around? And gave us Alex and Mikey's settings and said, oh, yeah, this is the area where you need to be. And we sort of had to work around that point. So we rode in Jerez and had a huge crash. We had went to Misano, had another crash there in qualifying, had no confidence in the front, didn't really matter, you know, with small changes or anything, we couldn't get the bike to work. So I just, Loris always said the bike feels really low at the rear and I can't stop it, I can't turn mid-corner, I've got no grip after three laps. And so I just said, okay, listen, you know, let me try something. It'll be a little bit left field, but let me try it. So Donington, he went out and came in. He was, you know, reasonably well, top sort of eight, I think, in first practice, and said, yeah, normal thing. I can't stop. I can't turn. It feels really low at the rear. So I'd already lined the mechanics up and we lowered the rear of the bike by a good step, sort of 10 to 15 millimetres. And everybody was kind of looking at me strange, like, lower the bike? I said, yeah, just lower it. I need to do it. But just be careful when you go out. I'm not sure about ground clearance. Just go ride it. So, yeah, off he went and came in sort of afterwards going, it's unbelievable. It feels like my bike. You know, it stops, it turns. But, yeah, it's just doing things that don't maybe follow the normal pattern of what anybody would think, but it's understanding what it is your rider's actually looking for. And his feedback might not be at that time 100% accurate, but being able to interpret it and change that into a positive change. And I think that's where you start to gain some really good trust between you and your rider.
Now, I think, was it 15 millimetres you said there, Mick?
Yeah, it was a reasonable step change at the time.
Because I was just thinking, obviously, to you, that's a reasonable... I mean, 15 millimetres to most people doesn't sound like much, but how much would you normally change something like that by, just to put that into perspective, or would you not change it at all?
Yeah, we'll change. If he's complaining maybe a steering at a corner, we might change 1 millimetre or...
Wow, okay.
You know, it'd be small sort of changes. So, yeah, to make a change that was so drastic. I mean, it was like 15 millimetres at the rear and 5 millimetres higher at the front. So it was quite a big step change all in one go. And we ended up that weekend at Donington sort of from being down in 12th to 14th place. I think we finished fifth in one race and we were the top Yamaha in two out of the three races. So it was definitely positive.
And just for people who may well be wondering at home, how do you make sure, you know, you've only adjusted it by, let's say, 3 millimetres and you've not accidentally done it by 2 or 4? You know, how is it so precise?
Yeah, everything's measured, you know, vernier caliper measurements, and we have certain jigs and tools which we can use to hang on the bike so that we're adjusting to an exact number. So I work with my mechanics and we have quite a system really, so they know what it is that I'm looking for or what I'm after, or I'll give them a target number that they need to get to and they'll do it. But yeah, the crew's so good, they're used to working in these ways. Everything that we do really is adjusted by millimeters, so it's kind of normal for us in a way.
Yeah, it's fascinating the detail that goes into it. Let's go right back, Mick, because obviously I think it's fair to say most people listening to this will watch all the shows. If they're listening to the podcast, they probably watch all the practice sessions, all the races. They're quite diehard fans, let's say. How about you? How did it all start for Mick Shanley? What was the first sort of contact you had with a motorcycle in your life?
Yeah, I kind of didn't have much option, really. I was sort of born in February, and my mum and dad had me at the Isle of Man TT in June. So
wow, really, wow.
That was that. I grew up with it from the very beginning and got my own first little Push Magnum 50X at 3 years old, and that was it. You know, I didn't really spend any time away from a bike all the way from being a child. My father, you know, I credit him for a lot for all my mechanical knowledge. He had a car and truck garage, and it actually, growing up, my father's car and truck garage that I went to every weekend and every school holiday backed onto Philip and George Fogarty's haulage yard, obviously Carl Fogarty's dad. So yeah, I used to go and blitz my little bike up and down the sort of loading yard there at Fogarty's place, and Carl would be down every now and again. Obviously, he was older than me. But yeah, I sort of grew up in that environment around those sort of people, and always went to all the race meetings and worked on my bike and worked on cars and trucks with my dad. And things progressed, obviously, as I got older. So yeah, I've been fortunate to make a career out of my passion, really.
So you must have got to know Carl Fogarty very well then. And what was it like seeing Carl over the years coming up through the ranks and winning races, winning championships?
Yeah. I used to go and see him as I was a little kid at Aintree and Alton Park and club racing and things like that. And then obviously as he got faster and kind of used to go training Martha Crossing and the local go-kart circuit in Blackburn. We used to go there when he was kind of at his height in 95 and 96. And just always had a sort of good time. And we don't see each other very often, but occasionally when I go home now and go and see my parents, we might bump into each other in the local pub and sort of have a catch up and things. And yeah, my wife's like, oh God, that's it. That's my night over with. Just been motorbikes all night. But yeah, it's good just to catch up every now and again and sort of, yeah, chat about things.
And you've met a load of riders, obviously, over the years, Mick. Is there something different, in your opinion, even though you've worked with them and you're used to how they are? Are they a different sort of breed, a different kind of human being, the real top riders? Is there a sort of very selfish streak about them, maybe?
Yeah, there can be, but I think it's necessary. I think anybody that really has to push to the absolute limit,
yeah,
you have to have that single-minded focus to do that. And different riders work in different ways. You know, I've known riders that are an absolute pain at race meetings, and as soon as they go out the circuit gate, they're a different person. But it's the same, I think, for a lot of people. When you're in that environment, you're there to work, and that is your job. And people view it from the outside like, you know, it's their hobby, it's what they're interested in. But for those people that are in there trying to win championships, it's your job and it's what you're focused on. It's what you've worked all week, spending hours watching, you know, reruns and analysing data and looking at chassis programs and making plans. And it's those times at the race meeting that this is it. This is what we've done all this preparation work for. So it's, you've got to be quite focused and single-minded, I think, to be able to achieve that sort of level of things. But I think in general, they are a different breed. Things that they can feel on a bike and things that they come back with, it's like the world happens in slow motion for them, I think. It's some of the things that explain about what they're doing on a bike and, you know, how using the rear brake to slide the rear and unload the front because they can feel the front tucking. And I'm thinking, yeah, I try and ride a bike like that. I feel the front tucking. I'm either on my ear or I'm in the gravel trap having stood it up. But they're actually manipulating controls on the bike to play with that edge, which is, yeah, incredible.
Well, if you're saying that, what chance has anyone else got? If you're a pro crew chief working in the World Superbike Championship, you know, let's say a top track day rider, more or less, Mick, let's say you go to Donington Park, how much slower would a quick track day rider be than one of these pros, more or less? I'm trying to put a number to it.
Yeah, I guess around Donington, you know, I work with a few guys with my own sort of side business that I've got, but they'll sort of do Donington at, you know, 12, 15 seconds a lap slower than what the World Superbike guys are, which is absolute night and day. It's a different world altogether.
And that's a top track day rider. That's the quickest guys.
Yeah, yeah, generally. You know, we sort of raced, I think, in 20... We qualified 27s, but racing 28s or something like that at Donington. And, you know, guys that are managing to get down to 40s, maybe a high 39 is a quick track day rider at that point.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it? Just going back to Loris for a second then. Starts, you mentioned before, mate, they've improved dramatically, haven't they? Fifth on the grid in Qatar last year. And he went backwards every time, didn't he? But this year, Phillip Island, as Loris said in the podcast a couple of weeks ago, he was very pleased with his start. So are those electronic settings or is it mechanical? What else can you change on the bike to get off the line as well as he is now?
Yeah, we've identified a couple of bits. Some of the electronic settings have been, you know, we've been able now to adapt them a little bit more this year than what we were capable of last year. Which has definitely helped with sort of launch off the line and then the drive. But we've been working on a couple of small other things really just to help, you know, mechanically to get the clutch out and stop the thing wheeling so much off the line. So all these little things, just trying to improve in every little bit of an area, definitely has an impact and can has added up to being able for us to not only just maintain a position off the line, which would have been a huge step, but we actually managed to make one or two positions forward, really.
And what about engine? Because I think you guys were running, was it a modified 2019 engine in Australia, and we were expecting a 2020 engine perhaps from around Aston, if I'm not mistaken. But obviously we don't know now what's going to happen with the rounds. But are you expecting engine updates?
Yeah. This is another kind of frustrating thing a little bit at the moment. You know, we've got all this time on our hands at present, but we can't even, because Yamaha Europe, the race base is just outside Monza. Everything's on complete lockdown in Northern Italy at the moment. So we can't actually get our 2020 engines out of Italy. They sat there ready. All the components are sat there ready, but we can't actually get them. We were due to get them last Monday. The country got put in full shutdown. So we have everything there sort of ready. As soon as we can get maybe, you know, shipping relaxed a little bit, then it'll be sent directly to us. So hopefully, you know, by the time we do get out on track, we should have the 2020 material.
So just to clarify for you, those of you listening, when Mick says last Monday there, we're referring to the 9th of March. So hopefully by the time you're listening to this, those engines might be somewhere closer to Tenkata in the Netherlands. But I mean, it's just such a weird situation we've got, isn't it? To not know when we're going racing again. As you said before, Mick, we've not had Qatar. Jerez has been moved. Aston and Imola are looking unlikely, I think it's fair to say. We don't know when the next round is going to be.
No. All we can do is just prepare the best that we can do. This will be the biggest kind of gap that we've had in any racing really for a long time. So, yeah, we've just got to...
It's a shame though, isn't it, this year when we've got a good calendar which has been closed up with no big gaps as we've had, and then this happens.
Yeah, we've got this. And then obviously we had three incredible races in Australia. And I know Loris, for one, was just biting. He couldn't wait to get back on the bike at the next round. And, you know, we're all sort of here chomping at the bit. We feel as a team, as Tenkata and Loris, that we've got a real chance to get some good, strong results and be competitive. But it's like being a child at Christmas who's not allowed to play with his toys, you know. We want to get going again and we want to do what we do, but... Yeah, we've got to kind of follow as things are worldwide. It's a problem. It's something that's been taken out of racing's hands, and I'm sure governments will be doing whatever they're doing for the best of everybody.
Yeah, it's like a kid, isn't it, getting his Christmas presents, as you say, but not being able to actually play with them till Easter or something like that. It's a bit of a frustrating one. But what about Mick Shanley now then? What happens between now and whenever the next round is? Can you get a few Donington track days in, maybe?
Yeah, it'd be nice. It'd be nice. No, we'll see how it is. I've got like my little sideline business, so I help out a few people here and there with bikes. So I've been doing a little bit of that, but also, you know, always working on 10 Carter things as well, trying to invent new programs on the laptop for analyzing data and some 3D CAD drawing to make some new parts. While we've got time, we can sort of do some of these development things, which take a little bit longer. So we've been fortunate now that the crates have been delivered back to the workshop because of this extended delay. So the guys can prepare things over there. And yeah, I'll just do whatever I can do over here at the minute. Depending on travel restrictions, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, we're hoping we can maybe get a test in. But that, yeah, purely depends on kind of Dutch government and UK government and things at the moment to make sure that we can travel when we need to.
Yeah, I was going to say, last question. Let's just say there was no travel restrictions in place at the moment. What are the rules? Is it 8 days, I think, you get during the season of testing?
Yeah, it's something like that. We don't normally use all the days that are available. I'm not sure that it's 8 or 12. But yeah, as long as we nominate to the organisation that we're going to test on this day and this day, it sort of gets knocked off our allocation then. I believe things like Suzuka 8-hour, if you do that, say the event is classed as a day or 2 days from from your overall sort of allocation. So yeah, it'd be nice if we could get out and do a little bit, you know, even for the rider, just to keep fresh and keep going. Because yeah, if and when we are allowed to go, for sure it'll be maximum attack. So we want to be ready for it.
Well, Mick, best of luck with everything. Hopefully you do get a test in and you can get your hands on those engines very soon. Not quite sure when I'm going to see you again, but we'll definitely be in touch, and good luck for the rest of the season.
Yeah, no trouble. Thanks, Greg. Look forward to getting back and seeing you at a racetrack soon.
Thank you to Mick. Good luck to Mick, to Loris Baz and the rest of the 10 Carter team for whenever, if this 2020 season continues. But it's funny, isn't it? We've been talking about a new decade, and at the moment it looks as though it might be a decade of 9 years. Who knows what's going to happen, but everything utterly, completely up in the air. Still many more questions being asked than being answered at the moment, but we will be back with Full Throttle next week. The clocks, of course, now have already gone forward. We will be into April as well by then, and spring very much underway, but not quite as we were expecting. Thanks from Greg Haynes. Thanks from Eurosport. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. And many thanks for listening to Full Throttle, the bike racing podcast from Eurosport. We'll be back with you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.